For March 9th, 2019, this is the Best of Rain. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. In the early to mid-1960s, the Swan Company was the mainstay in ham radio with their release of single sideband monoband radios like the SW120, SW140, and SW175, followed by multiband transceivers like the 240, 350, and 400. In 1966, Swan released the Swan 500, which was similar to its predecessor, the 350. In fact, the finals, a pair of six HF5 sweep tubes, were, however, the same. The 350 was rated at 350 watts peak envelope power, and the 500 was rated at 500 watts peak envelope power. Why? We now continue the 1993 interview Rains Hapali, KC9RB, conducted with Swan's founder, Herb Johnson, W6QKI.
We learned that we could run more power to the tubes. We increased the voltage that we ran on the finals, and that's how we were able to rate it for 500.
But why would I buy a 500 if I had a 350 already? What was the advantage be?
Well, you got a noise limiter, facilities to plug in a box unit on the back, and also a socket to plug in an auxiliary VFO if you wanted that option, that sideband selection.
Now, this was before Vox and the certain VFO became standard, which they did some years later.
Well, now the Collins had Vox immediately.
Why didn't the Swan?
I didn't like Vox operation myself. And I started finding out that if you explained to somebody that you didn't have Vox, they would usually say, oh, okay, I'll turn off my Vox then because I really don't like it anyway. Everybody else put Vox in automatically in the rig, starting with Collins. The Drake had Vox, National, and later on a company called Galaxy, Leo Meyerson. And nobody really knew how many people would pay extra for the Vox except us.
Will Hitchit any competition to you?
No, because it was usually a kit. They always had a hard time competing with commercially made equipment. It had very little trade-in value.
You came out with Swan 500, then what?
Oh, then there was a 500C, and then the 500CX. They were all relatively minor changes. They were not really made to try to sucker guys into buying a different model. It was just making little improvements and then trying to identify them. But there were a lot of people who, as soon as the next model comes out, they want to rush in and trade in for the newest model.
After the Swan 500 came out, then what?
About that time, the business had grown to where we had 160 employees. We reached that point about 1967. There's a lot of responsibility and demand on time, and the idea of merging with somebody else came up. A local stockbroker in Oceanside, who I'd befriended, we talked about the possibility of merging. So he started looking around for possible mergers. That was in the early days of merging. It hadn't really started at that time. We talked to people as big as Bendix, down to many smaller companies. And finally, we got acquainted with Cubic in San Diego, an electronics firm. They got interested in the idea, so we became their first acquisition.
What year was that?
1968.
What did it mean to have them as an acquisition?
Well, it gave me a chance to get away and go sailing more often.
Did you still have say in company policy? Were you still running it more or less?
Yes. It was a subsidiary of Cubic, meaning that it was still its own corporation, had its own board of directors.
But you were no longer the owner.
Yeah, that's it. I traded the stock in Cubic for the ownership of Swan. Yet I was still the CEO of the Swan subsidiary and sat on the board of Cubic for 5 years.
Until, what, 73?
Yeah.
Why did you finally leave altogether?
Well, when you've sold a company, there comes a time when you feel as though it's time to move on and do something else.
What equipment did Cubic come out with under the Swan label from 68 to 73?
Well, there was a 700CX and a 750CW. The last product I designed for Swan was called the Swan 600. There was an R and a T. They were separate units.
Did you design the 270 Signet?
Yes.
What year was that? That was the late 60s.
Originally was a 260 that came out in 1970.
What was different about that radio?
It had a single tube in the final and contained its own AC and DC power supply.
Wasn't that the first radio that you could operate off 12 volts?
I think, you know, I hadn't really thought about that before, but I believe that's true.
One of the drawbacks about it is it covered the entire 10-meter band on one mechanical band.
Yeah, it made it a little bit tight for tuning on 10 meters.
One of the comments Swan users made was that there was always a problem with suppressing the carrier. Was that a problem with the actual operator, him or herself, or was there a real problem in trying to get rid of that carrier insertion?
It was no problem except cockpit trouble. There was a balance control right on the front panel, and you just simply null the carrier. Some of the problems that get passed along on the ham bands are like phantoms. Self-appointed experts who like to criticize find fault, and then you check into it and you don't find any substance.
Well, in 1973 you left, but you reappeared later on, didn't you, with a company called Atlas?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And tell me the story about that.
Well, that company started production in 74. Well, actually in 73, because we delivered the first radios in January of 74. And they were all solid state. I worked with a New Zealander named Les Earnshaw, who had come to this country and started a company in Escondido, California, just over the hill. Les and I had become friends, and he suggested that I ought to build a solid-state transceiver similar to the Manpack radio, military-type radio that he had designed and was starting into production.
What was the name of his company?
Southcom International. We made, you might say, a ham radio version of his Manpack radio. In the process, of course, we made it tunable rather than channelized, and made it so it would tune 20, 40, 80, and 160. That was called the Model 180. 180 was the PEP input power to the first model, and that was introduced in January of 74.
By that time, of course, Yaesu had come into the market, and Kenwood. Why come out with another radio? What did you hope to gain by adding another transceiver to the market that was already fairly congested?
Well, the Atlas radio, that when we first came out with that, it was the only solid-state radio on the market.
100%?
Yes, entirely solid-state.
How well did that radio sell?
Well, in the course of 5 years, we turned out 23,000.
From 74 to 79?
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Well, then the pressure of Japanese imports who targeted our little amateur radio market decided they're going to take it over. At least that's the result of what they did. I don't blame the Japanese. I blame our own government for allowing things like that to happen. During 1 year, the year 1980, they took Drake, Swan, Cubic, and Atlas off the market, and also Collins.
You're listening to a 1993 interview with Herb Johnson, W6QKI, the man behind the Swan and Atlas companies. In the remainder of this retrospective of both the Swan and Atlas companies, you'll hear some discussion surrounding tariffs, or rather the lack thereof. This is the best of Rain.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
What would you have liked to have seen the government do?
Well, there's a purpose for having a tariff. That purpose is to establish a level trading field. If you're trading with another country, it should be an even trade. And if it's not even, which means there's a deficit on one side or the other, you've got to adjust that. And our government has failed to do that. They've allowed the Japanese to move into our electronic markets, television, VCRs, all of that, automobiles, and come in with what is just simply unfair trade.
But isn't that the price we pay for having a free enterprise and a capitalistic system?
Yeah, but there's got to be some kind of protection against a country like Japan who doesn't like to trade fairly. They want everything in their favor. I don't really have the answer. I know a lot of people defend the system the way it is. But there are millions of jobs that have left this country. And if we don't keep industry in this country, our standard of living will disappear.
So, of course, part of the reason millions of jobs have left this country is because labor is cheaper south of the border, and companies are taking labor and jobs out of the country. So it's not necessarily that is the government's fault, but it's not free enterprise or capitalistic system's fault.
Well, the only way I know to control it is for the government to have certain regulations on what can take place. Even the people in Mexico have been smarter than us. For years, you have not been allowed to export into Mexico anything if there's already a company in Mexico that's making that product. The Japanese do the same thing. They won't let our rice farmers sell rice to Japan. Instead, their own people have to buy rice from the Japanese rice farmers, and they're paying five times the world prices for rice.
And if we retaliate with tariffs, won't they do the same?
Probably so.
So it's a no-win situation.
Yeah, I don't know the answer, except I only know that when we looked at Japanese radios in 1979 and by coincidence learned that Drake had done exactly the same thing, came up with the same conclusion, we would meet at conventions and talk about this. The selling price of a Kenwood or a Yaesu was lower than what our cost of material would be to build the same product. My only question I can ask people who love to go and buy Japanese products is, what should the American company do?
You have now revived Atlas, but the playing field isn't any more level than it was, is it?
Yeah, I had to start with nothing, just like I did when I started Swan. And so I've had to find people who could invest a little money in the new Atlas, and they're very hard to find. I'm not certain yet that I can make a success of it.
But why now?
Because I think the American people are waking up. There's tremendous pressure against imported products now. I sense from all of many phone calls I get, that's why I have to have an answering machine on the business phone. You and I are talking on the house phone. The phone rings every day with 20 up to 30 calls every day from people who want information on the new radio. And almost everyone has a little tag on before they hang up. So sure glad to see an American company getting back into the market.
I'm delighted as well. But if I still have only X number of dollars to shell out on ham gear, and if hams are cheap as they notoriously have been traditionally, I would still say you're in for a tough battle. Not saying you can't win it, but I think...
To me, it seems like very short-sighted way to look at it. Because of the number of the millions of jobs that have been lost to products coming in from other countries, particularly from Japan, I believe in fair trade, but I don't believe in unfair trade. And unfair trade is when it's tilted so that there's a big deficit. We've been running a deficit with Japan over $400 billion in the past 10 years. And what do they do with all the U.S. dollars that they collect? They come over here and buy our property. to me, that's the craziest thing in the world. They come over here and buy businesses, properties, and they're doing it with our money. They also take the dollars they get from the United States and send their lobbyists to Washington to lobby for things that are good for Japan. They fill up the pockets of the politicians to vote a certain way.
Well, I think that also applies to our own domestic business as well as international business of other countries. So Japan is not unique in that respect.
No, that's true, but I think they're experts at it.
Of course, one can argue that it's our fault because we helped them get rebuilt as we dropped the bomb on them in 1941. So while you may have a government that's not playing fair on their behalf, they just learned very well how to play the game.
Well, I have a lot of respect for the Japanese intelligence. They're smart people.
Have you ever found any of them snooping around trying to get ideas or get secrets from what you were doing?
Oh, I could tell when the Yaesus first started coming over here. They looked definitely as though they had a relationship with the Swan transceiver. They used the TV sweep tubes for one thing like we'd been doing. The schematics were very similar to begin with.
So I think we've covered it pretty well. Swan was around from 59 till 68. Cupic took Swan over in 68. Cupic then phased out of ham radio entirely 12 years later in 1980.
And that concludes another gem from the RAIN archive, the Swan Atlas story, a retrospective with Herb Johnson, W6QKI, the founder of both Swan and Atlas Radio. Herb was interviewed in 1993 by RAIN's Hap Holly, KC9RP. The Best of RAIN updates Saturdays on therainreport.com. These hamcasts air Saturday nights around 7:30 p.m. Central Time on WTWW, which broadcasts out of Lebanon, Tennessee on 5,085 kHz. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network. Keep on hamming!